let you know that we're aware it's a little toasty in here. And it's a issue not that you have caused, but that is being experienced throughout the building. And the engineers are trying to do what they can. We apologize, it's not more comfortable for you.
Conserve a little bit. Oops, sorry.
That's good.
Where are your LEDs?
Maybe that'll help a little. We'll be back on the record. Ms. Hayes.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. Hello again.
Hello again, too.
All right. I would like to point you to page 5 of your testimony, starting at line 101.
Got it.
You say there is no reason to apply different standards to rooftop solar versus a QF with regard to energy value, capacity value, integration costs, or the imputation of environment. Oh, I'm so sorry. Just, would you like me to start over?
I think before you do that, we tried to open some doors, but I'm having difficulty hearing just because of noise in the hall, so I think we'll at least close these couple. Thank you, Mr. Rossini. Maybe we can leave a couple open in the back and get some. Let's try, see if we can get a little cross breeze going. Thank you. Ms. Hayes.
Thank you. So back to my reading, which I will do slower. At line 101, you say there is no reason to apply different standards to rooftop solar versus a QF with regard to energy value, capacity value, integration costs, or the imputation of environmental costs or other adders. These were all decided in docket number 12035100. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you participated in that docket, correct?
Yes, I did.
And the issue of whether it was appropriate to evaluate demand-side solar in the same manner as supply-side QFs was not addressed in that docket, was it?
No, it was not.
But here you're asking the commission to make that determination. Is that correct?
That's correct. I've presented the information in this docket from that docket as what I think is something the commission can rely on.
Okay. Are you familiar with Utah docket number 090-3527?
Not by number.
Okay. It was called in the matter of the proposed revisions to the Utah demand-side resource program performance standards.
I wouldn't have been involved in that.
Okay, so that wasn't something you consulted in making your recommendation?
No, it was not.
And so I'm assuming you're not aware that the Utah Commission has specifically ruled on the issue of evaluating distributed solar programs as demand-side resources versus supply-side resources?
I'm not aware, no.
All right. Are you familiar with the 5 demand-side management cost-effectiveness tests?
I have seen them recently, but I'm not. I don't work with them.
All right. and so you're not aware that the 5 cost-effectiveness tests that are used in Utah to evaluate demand-side management programs are similar to the solar cost benefit analysis recently completed in Nevada?
Well, that's actually where I saw it, was in the E3 study in Nevada, okay. And they had the five different tests.
Okay. And so based on the fact that you didn't review this docket, you're not asked, I suppose you haven't made a recommendation to the commission to revoke its prior ruling to evaluate distributed solar consistently with demand-side management programs?
Yeah, as I said, I'm not familiar with that.
All right. And then just one question about avoided costs for kicks and giggles. PURPA avoided costs deal with sales of electricity to the utility. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Whereas net metering is a billing mechanism that credits kilowatt hour generation against consumption. Is that correct?
Well, I would characterize it as, it could be thought of as sale to the utility at the tail block rate. The tail block rate.
Okay. No further questions.
Thank you. Redirect.
Yeah. Mr. Duvall, I just have two short topics to cover with you. The first is I'll direct your attention to some questions you were asked excuse me, by Mr. Rossetti, and it was the line of questions about whether or not you knew how much the company was getting or pocketing for the power that he, you know, his system was, you know, providing to the neighbor. And I guess I just want to ask this to clarify your testimony for the commission. Is it your understanding that the power company is able to, for free, because I believe that was the implication, provide power to whether it's Mr. Rossetti's neighbor or anyone else as a result of excess provided by net metered customers?
No.
So can just to explain then, why or why not?
Yeah, the limited understanding I have is that if a customer generates more than they use from their net metering, it gets into the system, but it's included in their bank. And so when that's returned to them, the company has to generate something to make that power.
And so is what you're saying equivalent to the credit at retail rate?
Yes.
The second topic I wanted to address with you is you were asked by counsel, actually by multiple counsel, on the QF docket 12-035-100. You recall those questions?
Yes, I do.
And you had, in an answer, stated words to the effect that in that docket, the commission had recently declined to attribute value to avoided environmental risk or price hedges, fuel hedges, and a question was asked, do you know why they did that? And you responded words to the effect, well, I'd have to read the order. Do you recall that line
of
questioning?
Yes, I do.
If I might approach.
Yes.
I apologize. Not knowing I'd be doing this, I don't have a copy, but I'll represent to everyone that I'm handing Mr. Duvall a copy of the order in 12-035-100, and I'm turning to pages 41 to 42. Ask you, Mr. Duvall, I've underlined, please note that's not part of the original order, a couple of lines, if you could just read that really quickly, the invoice section.
Okay. We have a difficult time, however, drawing a correlation between avoided distribution and transmission costs that may be projected and tested with a reasonable degree of certainty, e.g. through transmission studies, and environmental risk factors, e.g. costs associated with adapting to changing climate, based upon divergent and speculative projections.
And then the next sentence
Thus, for the foregoing reasons, we approve no specific adjustments to value fuel price hedging, fuel price volatility, or environmental risks.
So, Mr. Duvall, I need a note, Sue, by the way. Do you have an objection for you?
No, I just actually wanted to know what page you were on, because my own copy of that order.
41 to 42. And I was about to note for the record, this will help you as well. The sections I had underlined, there's actually a paragraph in between those two lines that he read. So the first paragraph was in the first full paragraph on page 41, and the second one was the first full paragraph of page 42. Mr. Duvall, does that refresh your memory as a participant in that docket of what the commission's findings were to answer the question that was posed to you of, do you know why the commission declined to assign a value to the potential of diverting threatened environmental risks?
Yeah, from what I just read, the commission determined that the estimates were speculative.
And as a participant, and again, following up on the question that you were posed, was it your understanding that that was based on some kind of legal limitation or a factual determination?
That would have been a factual determination.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. Ms. Roberts, any questions based on those?
Yes, I do have one clarifying question. Mr. Duvall, as you just testified, your understanding was that the commission's decision to reject including these other avoided costs was based on the inadequacy of the evidentiary record in that matter?
Yeah, that the estimates that were presented into the record were too speculative for the commission to adopt them for purposes of avoided costs.
Mm-hmm. So is it possible that such evidence could be presented that would establish a quantitative basis for those avoided costs that could satisfy the commission?
Well, I think I don't know. I mean, as I recall, UCE had presented testimony in that case and had some numbers they put together, and those were rejected. So they'd have to present something different.
Okay. So the commission has not held as a legal matter that there are no such avoided costs associated with solar resources, no fuel hedge costs, no avoided environmental costs. Is that your understanding?
If I understand your question right, yeah, the decision to exclude those costs was not based on legal opinion.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Anything further?
No, thank you.
Since I was mentioned by counsel, am I allowed to address?
If you'd like to, yes, Mr. Rossetti, sure.
Thank you. Appreciate the introduction. When a customer who generates excess electricity, regardless of where that excess goes, they get a credit. Is that correct?
They do. That's right.
Later in the day, they redeem that credit, which means electricity is coming into their facility, their house, for which they don't have to pay. Is that correct? Because it's a credit. They're getting a full retail rate credit.
Yeah, they get paid full retail rate for that excess power.
Okay. And the argument is because we're actually that customer redeeming that credit is using the grid, then they therefore should have to pay their share of the fixed costs based on the consumption that they've redeemed the credit for, correct?
But that was the subject of Ms. Stewart's testimony.
But you mentioned it, and he just brought it up. So I'm just trying to be clear here, because you know how the system works, right?
Right.
That's your job. Okay. Then whoever gets that excess electricity, however far it goes in the network, they pay full price for that electricity.
That's right. They pay full price, and the NEM customer receives the full price.
Thank you. And the customer that pays full price did not incur, I'll be specific here, 100% of the cost to the company to provide that electricity. Is that correct?
I don't know that I could have the expertise to answer that question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Oskin? I have a couple questions, Mr. Duvall.
Okay.
If I want to try to understand the benefits associated with the net metering customer's power that's generated, would I be right to take, in your mind at least, the avoided cost number that you've proposed, the 3 cents a kilowatt hour, and multiply that times the total generation of the net metering customers on Utah? Would that give me a sense of the dollar benefit that those customers are affording?
Yes, it would.
And then if I wanted to understand the cost, would I be right to take the charge that the company's proposed? Again, this is from the company's perspective. And multiply that times help me. What would I multiply that by?
To get the cost?
To get the cost.
Yeah, it would be the 8.8 cents to 14.4 cents.
The full retail rate that you've described.
Yeah. And when you mentioned the cost to the company, that's, you know, really in a rate case, that's cost to non-NEM customers.
Thanks.
All right.
Any other questions from other commissioners? Thank you. Any follow-up, Mr. Moskin? Okay. You're excused, Mr. Duvall. Thank you. Mr. Moskin?
That concludes the company's witnesses.
Thank you. Mr. Jetter?
One of our witnesses is still having travel difficulties, and so we've discussed it with the Office of Consumer Services, and we're going to reverse order if that's okay with the commission.
That's a good approach. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
And thanks to the office for your flexibility. Mr. Coleman.
Thank you.
Before you sit down, Mr. Gimbel. But we're glad you've set a good example for everyone here by taking your coat off. I hope no one's got their coat on out of formality. Yeah, thank you. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Thank you. Please be seated. Mr. Coleman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Gimbel, will you state your name and position business title for the record?
Yes, my name is Daniel E. Gimbel. I'm a manager with the Office of Consumer Services, 160 East, 300 South, here in the Heber Wells.
Thank you. As part of your responsibilities in this docket, did you cause to be filed a rebuttal testimony dated June 26, 2014, as well as an attached exhibit, OCS Exhibit 5.1R?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections or modifications to that rebuttal testimony?
No.
If I were to ask you those questions again today, would your answers be the same?
They would.
Did you also cause to be filed in this docket surrebuttal testimony dated July 17th, 2014?
I did.
Do you have any corrections or modifications to that testimony?
I do not.
If I asked you those same questions today, would your answers be the same as contained in your pre-filed testimony?
They would.
At this time, I would move for admission of Mr. Gimbel's rebuttal and surrebuttal testimony, exhibits OCS 5R. Gimbel, along with the associated exhibit OCS exhibit 5.1R, as well as OCS, exhibit OCS-5SR Gimbel into the record.
Any objections? They're received.
Mr. Gimbel, do you have a summary statement of the office's position?
I do.
Will you please proceed?
Good afternoon. Warm afternoon, I guess. Let me just start with our recommendation. The office recommends that the commission approve a residential net metering charge of $1.54 a kW in this case. Since our proposed rate design is based on the rated size of individual PEV systems, net metering customers with smaller...
Mr. Gimbel, I'm sorry. Can you slow just a touch for our...
Sure.
...for the benefit of our reporter? Thank you.
Smaller solar PV systems will pay less than net metering customers with larger systems. The office notes that a dollar per kW rate design is consistent with the approach recently implemented last December by the Arizona Commission on an interim basis. Let's talk about the evidence. There's been a lot of discussion on that today already, a lot of exchange in terms of cross-examination. The office submits that there is sufficient evidence on the record to support implementing a net metering facilities charge in this proceeding. And I want to touch on a couple areas. First, cost shifting. The office believes that the company provided sufficient evidence showing a distribution-related cost shift from net metering residential customers to non-net metering residential customers. Absent the proposed facilities charge, this cost shift will increase as participation in the net metering program expands. Another point I want to make, the lower and variable energy requirements of the net metering customers, coupled with the fact that the fixed distribution costs are recovered via energy rates in the present rate design, results in net metering customers not paying an appropriate share of costs needed to invest in and maintain the distribution system. So from a cost causation standpoint, net metering customers still rely on the distribution grid when their PV systems are offline, in the evening hours, overnight, early morning, not producing sufficient energy to meet load needs. This can happen at any time during the day because that energy or the production they produce is intermittent. If you have stormy weather, those systems could be fully down or partially down. And there's a third way they use the system, and that's to export power into the grid. So that's the first area. The second area is that I want to talk about in terms of the evidence is the value of solar. You've heard quite a bit about that. You just had Mr. Duvall up here talking about avoided costs. What the record shows is some parties submitted a new analysis of costs and benefits, while other parties referred to existing regulatory processes, such as avoided costs and IRP cases, where a similar set of costs and benefits were evaluated. In particular, the office found the commission's recent order in the avoided cost docket 12035100 to be compelling in a number of ways. And Mr. Duvall just talked about that. And I want to go touch on three points related to that order. First, the order indicates that the avoided cost rates for solar QF resources are substantially lower than the net metering avoided costs estimated by UCE and the Sierra Club. UCE is approximately 11.6 cents a kWh. The Sierra Club is about 6.1 cents a kWh. The avoided cost is about 3. Secondly, the order states that potential costs associated with environmental risks and fuel price volatility should be accounted for in the company's IRP modeling and evaluation process. So that's the commission's words there. Third, due to its policy of allowing QFs to retain RECs, the commission did not accept any proposed adjustments to value environmental risks or fuel price volatility in that avoided cost order. So what we draw from this is that the commission's findings are instructive because it does provide a value for solar resources using a well-established production cost model, grid, and also has a direct bearing on whether environmental risks, fuel price volatility, and so forth would be excluded or included in the valuation of net metering benefits. Okay. So just to conclude, while the office believes that the record is adequate, we fully realize that the commission may decide, based on the evidence presented in this record, to require additional cost-benefit analysis prior to authorizing either a net metering charge or credit. Obviously, if the commission goes in that direction, we don't oppose you going in that direction, and we will fully participate in that process. But we want to caution the commission a little bit. We would strongly recommend that the valuation method used by the commission fit the legal, policy, and factual circumstances that are unique to Utah and rely on information consistent with recent IRP and rate-making dockets, else you may end up with unintended consequences. So that's going to require the commission to take evidence, if you open up this new proceeding, on what specific cost and benefit categories, as well as modeling parameters, should be included in the net metering analysis. Lastly, the office would agree with the division that if you do open a separate docket to study this issue further, it should be concluded by about a year from now, mid-2015, at least prior to the next general rate case. I guess one final comment. Obviously, the net metering facilities charge has attracted considerable public attention. So the office believes it's very important for the commission to clearly communicate its net metering policy and expectations relating to the net metering rate changes, or alternatively, the process by which it intends to further evaluate net metering costs and benefits should you go down that path. And that concludes my summary.
Mr. Gimble would be available for cross-examination.
Mr. Rossetti.
My turn already? I wish I could take shorthand. So part of your claim, oh, hello.
Nice to meet you.
And good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Part of your claim is that net metering customers overall reduce their energy consumption.
Yeah, do you want to point to my, where in my testimony, or are you just
asking? You were just saying okay. In your summary that net metering customers not only generate excess, but they also overall reduce their energy needs from the grid.
Yeah, that's the primary benefit associated with their production is to reduce their energy needs. The export onto the grid is more of a secondary benefit.
Yeah.
That's my understanding of the program.
Yeah, okay. So ignoring any excess then, does this mean that you consider a net metering customer by just reducing their energy requirements from the grid is not paying, not helping in the recovery of the fixed costs?
Yes, I mean, if this net metering facilities charge is not approved and implemented by the commission, then there will be a cost shift from net metering customers to the rest of the residential class. Albeit a small cost shift, it is a cost shift.
Yes, but just to be clear, ignoring any excess that they might generate and get credit for, they reduce their energy consumption, and that means they've reduced their contribution to the recovery of fixed costs.
Yes.
Okay. And that's part of your justification, I believe.
Yes.
Okay. How is that different from conservation and efficiency measures?
I think there's a significant difference between a residential customer, I'll call it an EE, energy efficiency program, so EE program versus a net metering program. In terms of a customer that's on an energy efficiency program, their reduction is more permanent. If they go out and participate in a program that has a high efficiency refrigerator, for example, or some other kind of appliance, that is more certain in terms of the reduction to the load and more permanent versus the net metering customer whose load profile is more intermediate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if a customer go ahead.
I have other things that I can talk about in terms of distinguishing if you want to hear them, but that's one thing.
I'd love to hear them.
Another example that I raised in my testimony was the fact that quite a few residential customers participate in a load control program known as Cool Keeper. That's a dispatchable program. It's subject to the utility's control. The utility does not have that kind of control with net metering customers in terms of dispatchability. Mm-hmm. So there's a different kind of value to be assessed in terms of load control program versus net metering. So I think they're situated differently.
A net metering customer could enroll in the Cool Keeper program.
I believe they can, yes.
Yes. Okay.
Mr. Gimbel, did you have a chance to finish your answer?
I'm sorry.
I did.
Okay. So as I mentioned in my SUR rebuttal, I like doing N plus 1 and N minus 1 calculations. So would you consider it necessary to make any kind of adjustment, say, if half of the residential customers engaged in such aggressive conservation and efficiency measures that they dramatically reduce their bill, thus cost shifting to all those other half of customers the impact of reducing their energy consumption?
Again, I think the energy efficiency programs are a different, if you will, animal versus the net metering in terms of more predictability, more certainty. If there was a significant movement to join a program, I think all parties would want to take a look at the potential impacts of that.
Okay. So I hate to beat a dead horse here, but there's a lot of people that do engage in conservation and high efficiency. In fact, usually people putting solar in do that first. And just simply by doing that, we are shifting the fixed cost recovery to other customers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. I think that's all I'm qualified to ask.
Thank you.
I think I've realized I skipped over the company. Mr. Jetter, did you have questions? Boy, I apologize for that.
No, I actually thought I agreed with the format thinking, because otherwise, I might, as we go through the case thinking, will I be having my cross-examination questions rehabilitated by successive people? So I thought, okay, this is great. But no, we don't have any questions of this witness.
Mr. Jetter?
The division also has no questions for Mr. Gimbel.
I apologize.
I guess that means it's my turn, Commissioner Clark.
That's right. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gimbel. How are you today?
Good afternoon. Good to see you again.
Likewise. Nice to see you again. I want to go back to your rebuttal testimony on page 4, where you talk about the process being used in this case, and have you take a look at your answer on lines 100 through about 118, where you, if I am fairly summarizing your testimony, I think it would be to say that you think this is this whole net metering and fairness requires a separate DACA, deliberate review, full opportunity, including net metering cost benefit analysis from the company, and so on and so forth. Did I fairly summarize what you said?
Pretty much, yeah. That's.
And has that happened since your rebuttal testimony was filed? Did we get the company's net metering cost benefit analysis for all customer classes as required by SB 208, as you mentioned in lines 107? Or a technical conference from 109, or a collaborative process in line 117?
What the company did file was testimony, Mr. Duvall's testimony related to the avoided cost docket. We took a hard look at that, went back to the commission's orders, and responded to that in SUR rebuttal. So our position has evolved, as often happens in any kind of case, to supporting, we've supported the net metering facility charge all the way through our testimony, but in terms of the need for a cost-benefit study in a separate docket, our position has evolved on that, whereas if the commission wants to go down that path, you know, we're supportive of that. We don't oppose that, and we still think what we set forth here is, you know, what the commission should generally follow if it opens, you know, a separate docket. But our position has evolved.
But again, just so I'm clear, there hasn't been a net metering technical conference, as you suggested would be significant, right?
There hasn't been.
And there hasn't been a collaborative process, because it was just the company's SUR rebuttal testimony that was filed, correct?
Correct, but we did look at new evidence presented by the company that related to avoided cost docket 12-035-100, and like I just said, we took a closer look at that order and think there is evidence there for the commission to, based on, you know, the decisions that they made in that QF case, to go forward with a facilities charge in the current proceeding.
Right. Well, I understand that that fulfilled one of the items. I think the items on line 106 and 107. But when you talk in the next paragraph about a collaborative process and bringing in a variety of parties and so on and so forth, that didn't happen, right?
It hasn't happened, and this would be our proposal for a guideline for the commission to follow if they open a separate docket.
Great. And then the one piece that I wanted to follow up on, when you say you decided that what the company had done in the other case was adequate, did that cover all affected customer classes as required by SB 208? And I'm assuming you're getting at the point that this case really is just focused on the residential class, and it didn't do anything with the commercial classes yet. And I'm curious if you disagree with me that SB 208 wasn't restricted just to residential customers, was it?
My reading of SB 208 does extend beyond the residential class, but the net metering facilities charge is just applicable to the residential class. That's what the proposal is applicable to.
But wouldn't you agree that if it turned out that net metering, commercial net metering customers had a beneficial impact on the whole net metering system of the company, and there were, let's just say for the sake of discussion, that there were revenues generated from commercial net metering that provided a benefit that exceeded any cost of the residential net metering, that there may be a reason to look at those two things together. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I don't think Senate Bill 208 is clear on that.
Okay. And you've had a chance to look at studies in other states that took a look at net metering charges, correct?
I looked at Arizona.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Arizona for a minute. In Arizona, the Corporation Commission established, as you mentioned, an interim rate that was on a per kilowatt basis and appears to be the model that you followed. Is that right?
Based on what happened, transpired in that docket, it was something that, you know, the office helped the office develop its proposed rate design. So we did look at that and saw that they had an alternative approach to what the company was proposing here, which was a flat charge.
And in that Arizona case, did you happen to notice or do you recall how many experts testified before the commission and presented testimony and were cross-examined?
All I know is that RUCO testified before them. The Arizona staff had evidence in the record, because the commission entered a finding that in terms of the proposed net metering facilities charge offered up by the staff in RUCO, they entered a finding that it should be that the $3 per kW ballpark was reasonable.
RUCO, just to clarify, RUCO is the equivalent in Arizona of your office.
Yes.
Here, correct?
Correct.
And would it be fair to say that the result in that case was a result of a settlement among the parties?
That's my understanding. My understanding was a settlement between the solar interests and RUCO, and they presented that to the commission.
And there was, as you understand it, other than testimony from the one RUCO staff member, were there studies presented that fleshed out the costs and benefits in Arizona to Arizona Public Service and Arizona customers regarding the cost or benefits of net metering?
You know, I'm going to object to the question. I think, you know, the docket in Arizona is going to speak for itself. Mr. Gimbel didn't participate in the docket. He's indicated that, you know, the office looked at the analysis, but I'm not sure that that Mr. Gimbel can be expected to understand all the testimony and the numbers of witnesses that participated in a docket in a separate jurisdiction.
Well, Mr. Coleman, I understand your concern, but the point of it is, if the if the conclusion that the office has come to is that the Arizona Commission order has some precedential value and the office is taking a position that a charge similar to the Arizona charge is appropriate, and Mr. Gimbel has suggested that a full cost-benefit analysis with technical conference and collaborative process is the way to go, and they didn't do that in Arizona, and I'm certainly happy to have him answer subject to check, that would seem to undercut the value of that Arizona precedent, and that's the reason I think the question is a legitimate question.
I don't think he testified that the Arizona proceedings have a precedential value in Utah. I believe his testimony indicated that it speaks for itself, but I believe he testified that the office looked at and reviewed the Arizona proceeding as a model, but not as a precedential determination for this commission.
I think perhaps the use of the word precedential is incorrect, Commissioner, and I appreciate your clarifying that, Mr. Coleman. I think that it's the only example that Mr. Gimbel used as the basis for determining the office's charge. He's given no other examples as the basis for the charge of $1.50-something per kilowatt.
Again, I'm going to assert that Mr. Gimbel's testimony speaks for itself.
To the extent that the questions are phrased to address Mr. Gimbel's reliance on that proceeding and the outcome of that proceeding in preparing his testimony, we'll allow them. So would you rephrase your question?
Sure.
And proceed then,
sure,
please.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Mr. Gimbel, let's try to narrow this down a bit. Did you have a chance to determine if the Arizona Commission did the things that you suggested this commission do to fully vet the costs and benefits of net metering?
I haven't read all the testimony in that case, or really any of the testimony. I read the order.
Okay. And it was an interim order, correct?
It was an interim order.
Okay. And do you have any idea of the effect that that's had on applications for residential installations of solar in Arizona since January 1st, the effective date of that order?
I do not have any knowledge on that.
Well, let me ask you, subject to check, if you would be shocked to learn that the applications for solar dropped by about 50% after that charge was enacted. Do you think that's possible?
I don't have anything. I'd have to see okay. Something in front of me. I don't see any kind of information that would suggest that.
I apologize to the parties in the commission that I wasn't really anticipating using this. Mr. Kimball, let me just show you a screenshot. May I approach the witness, Your Honor? I apologize.
It's all right.
After the fact. Mr. Gilman, this purports to be a screenshot of a newscast from Arizona, and I'm just asking you if those numbers seem that appears to be legitimate, and I'm happy to have you do it subject to check.
It just shows when. So what is the source?
The source is a news channel in Phoenix.
Yeah, I'm going to, I guess I'm going to. I feel like I need to object to the foundation of the document. I mean, the accuracy of the information is unclear, and I'm not also sure really of the relevance of the effect of Arizona determinations and decisions made by Arizona customers to a Utah proceeding.
Coleman's implying that there's no effect of having a net metering charge. I'd be happy to have that put into the record as testimony, but the question is, Mr. Gimbel doesn't know anything about this and can't comment on it. I'll accept that as an answer. He's still looking at it.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Gimbel, have you ever seen this before? Do you know anything about the information that's presented there?
This is the first time I've seen this slide.
That's fine.
Okay.
Good, thank you. Let me just ask you that question generally, Mr. Gimbel. If there's a net metering charge of the sort you're proposing or the sort the company's proposing, do you have an opinion as to what effect that would have on new solar installations?
I think there's a myriad of factors that would go into a decision in terms of whether a customer would invest in a solar, a net metering facility in terms of a solar PV system, including, you know, the price of the system, the net metering facilities charge, obviously, would play into it. But other factors, investment tax credits, there's a number of things. How the roof is situated, are they situated, are they well situated for a solar PV rooftop apparatus?
And so those other factors being equal, if it costs more to put in solar rather than less because of the net metering charge, would you expect that to have an impact or not? In other words, if it cost, if all those things were in place that you mentioned and there was a net metering charge, do you think that would have an effect or not?
I'm not sure Mr. Gimbel's, I'm going to object, you know, you're asking for Mr. Gimbel to speculate upon potential net metering customers' decision-making processes, and I don't think he's qualified to make that determination.
He's asking for Mr. Gimbel's opinion. Do you have an opinion?
You want to re-ask, please?
Sure. If all the other items, the tax credit and so forth, remain in place, and we then add a net metering charge of some sort, either a per kilowatt charge, as you've suggested, or a flat charge that the company has proposed, do you think that would have a negative effect on applications for solar installations?
I mean, it could depend on where potential solar net metering customer thinks residential prices are going.
Okay. Let me go back to an item that came up in earlier testimony, and that was the proposal that I believe Ms. Stewart, Ms. Stewart mentioned that the company's planning on doing a load study later this year. Did you hear that testimony?
I heard that testimony, and I responded to it in my, believe, sir, rebuttal.
And do you believe that study will provide additional information that would be useful for the commission in making the full analysis required by SB 208?
I think it'll provide useful information on net metering load shape, load factor, and it'll be useful at least in the next general rate case in terms of perhaps designing a separate tariff for residential net metering customers, if it's available by then.
So
I should say if the results are available by then.
Sure. The company is hoping, I guess, that if the commission adopts their proposal that the net metering charge would take effect on or about September 1st of this year. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding.
And that would obviously be before that load study was even started, let alone completed, correct?
Correct.
And do you believe that to comply with SB 208, that load study should involve residential customers only, or it should also net metering customers, or it should include commercial net metering customers as well?
I think the focus should be on the residential net metering.
And is that based on your reading of Senate Bill 208?
I think given the context, there's already, in terms of the commercial class, there's already a demand charge there, as explained by the company's witness, Ms. Stewart. What we don't have is something comparable on the residential. So I think it's more important to launch the residential load research study and get that completed first.
You mentioned that you had looked at studies about the costs and benefits of net metering in other states, correct?
Can you point to my testimony?
I thought you just mentioned it in your summary, but give me a moment and I'll try to find that. Well, actually, let me just ask you if you did. That's simpler. Have you looked at other studies?
No, I just looked at my testimony just responds to Mr. I think it was Mr. Gilliam's testimony in terms of, I think Mr. Gilliam asserted that other states had concluded that benefits exceeded costs in terms of net metering benefits exceeded costs. And I just, in my sort of rebuttal, I rebutted that and just said a lot of that there is information out there saying that a lot of commissions are taking a fresh look at the net metering issue from a cost-benefit analysis standpoint.
And in your review of those studies to do that rebuttal, did any of them limit the study to residential class that you saw?
I can't recall.
Did the office support incentives for solar when that was before the commission?
I believe so, but I think we had some conditions in there that we recommended to the commission. I wasn't part and parcel of that docket, but I think we did have conditions in there.
And you'd agree, would you not, that if there are incentives, positive incentives for solar offered by the company to consumers, and at the same time there's a charge for net metering customers, it would have the effect of diluting those incentives? Do you agree with that?
I'm sorry, can you restate that?
Sure. If a customer is getting, I believe it was $1.20, is that the correct number for the incentives from Rocky Mountain Power that were in place this past year?
I believe so, but that's subject to check.
Okay, subject to check. And if a customer were to receive that incentive and then have to start paying a charge, a net metering charge, wouldn't you agree that that would dilute the incentive, meaning it would reduce it?
I can't speak for a net metering customer if that would reduce their incentive to.
Well, it's not an opinion question of what they think. It's if you give somebody 50 cents and you take back 10, have you reduced the amount that they have?
Yeah, just in terms of simple math.
Okay, great. Is it your testimony, Mr. Gimbel, that in the 12035-100 QF case that we've had some discussion about, that there was discussion about small-scale distributed generation solar on individuals' homes?
Is it my testimony that was addressed in that docket?
Yes.
That isn't my testimony.
Was it?
No.
Is it your testimony that the PURPA rules for qualifying facilities use a different criteria than the cost-benefit analysis that is implied by Senate Bill 208?
I'm going to object with and allow, you know, obviously allow the answer to the question, but to the extent that it calls for a legal conclusion, I would object.
I'm glad to respond to that, if you like, Commissioner.
Mr. Rowley, please.
The question really is, it's not a legal conclusion. If the office's position and the testimony that we have here is that that docket provided information that the commission should rely on here, then the question is whether there's a different standard used in that proceeding which would make it inapplicable to be directly utilized here. And so the question is whether there is a different standard being used in the QF analysis from what's required by Senate Bill 208. Obviously, Senate Bill 208 wasn't passed at the time of the earlier hearing, but it has been passed since. And so to rely on it, it would require that there be some compatibility between the two standards used in the two different cases. And what I'm asking Mr. Gimbel is whether he believes that the rules for QFs that were used in that earlier case are the same rules that are applicable to the full cost-benefit analysis required by Senate Bill 208 that's now in place, and that per the commission's earlier order, is to be considered in this case.
Yeah, Mr. Gimbel, do you understand the question, and do you have a response?
I'm not. To some degree, I understand it, but can you delineate the rules associated with Senate Bill 208 that you're specifically talking about?
Well, I'm not aware of any rules. Are you?
Well, that's what you just said. You said rules associated with Senate Bill 208. That's how I understood your question.
Okay, maybe I used a bad word. Let me try to redo. Senate Bill 208 requires a cost-benefit analysis. We agree on that?
It directs the commission to look at costs and benefits of net metering and impacts on the utility and affected customers. That's my understanding of Senate Bill 208.
Okay. And does PURPA and the regulations concerning qualified facilities use the same sort of mechanism and consider the same costs and benefits that you understand would be used in the analysis required by Senate Bill 208?
PURPA is federal legislation that dates back, I think, to the late 70s into the early 80s, and the standards there talks about the avoided cost standards is one of rate parity, neutrality, and indifference in terms of what the utility compensates to a QF provider. If that's the question.
Well, I guess the question is, are net metering customers the same as QFs?
No.
There was discussion earlier that the Nevada study that Mr. Duvall referred to mentioned the five cost-effectiveness tests that have frequently been used. Are those the same things as the cost-benefit analysis that you think would be required under Senate Bill 208?
I think the commission, as my testimony indicates after reviewing Mr. Duvall's testimony, that the commission could look at its order in 12035100 in the QF case and make a determination that based on the evidence and its order in that docket that it could approve the proposed net metering facilities charge. That's my testimony.
But it wouldn't be required or precedential.
Come again with that.
The commission doesn't have to say, we've already decided everything in this case, we're done with Senate Bill 208 because of the earlier case, and be done with it that way, right?
The only, as I understand Senate Bill 208, it just directs the commission to look at costs and benefits. Two parties have provided cost-benefit analyses. The company has provided evidence related to docket 12035100 that relates to the avoided costs that resulted in the office taking a closer look at the commission order, and we addressed that order in our rebuttal testimony in my summary today.
Okay, let me switch gears on a couple of other quick topics. You agree, do you not, that there's no evidence in the record that net metering customers have caused voltage control issues or any other damage to the company's system, correct?
Correct, not at this low penetration level.
And do you agree there's evidence in the record that net metering customers reduce the overall load of the company throughout the day and thus the company incurs fewer operational costs from those net metering customers?
I don't think my testimony says that.
At some point in your testimony, you proposed to grandfather existing net metering customers from any new charge adopted by the commission today, correct?
Yes, but I need to qualify that. I said that that's the office's preference, but there may be legal barriers in the commission if it wants to consider that. Should direct the party attorneys to address it in legal briefs.
I believe you mentioned in response to a question from Mr. Rossetti that you've thought that actions taken by energy efficiency customers were more permanent than the activities or the loads produced by net metering customers. Did I hear you correctly?
You did.
Would you agree that the 25 to 30 year life expectancy of solar panels probably exceeds the life expectancy of most of many light bulbs? Even not LEDs.
Yeah, I was going to go there.
That's a good point. Let's take CFLs. What about CFLs?
Probably CFLs, but LEDs maybe not.
maybe equivalent to LEDs, right? Okay. Does the office support policies which in general result in cleaner air in Utah?
I'm sorry, I was still.
You're still laughing. Does the office support policies which at this commission which may result in cleaner air in Utah?
In terms of the give me an example in terms of what you've in terms of cleaner air in terms of reducing PM10.
Well, let's just say in general in Utah that if would you agree that if less coal was burned to meet the power requirements of Utah customers, the air in Utah generally would be cleaner without worrying about the details of PM10, NOx, SOx, et cetera?
Well, if less coal was burned in Utah, then perhaps, you know, more coal would have to be burned in other states. I mean, it could be a zero-sum game.
Okay, well, let's say that enough solar was installed in Utah to eliminate half of the coal burning in Utah. Would that be a positive development?
I think it could be a positive development depending on if it was a cost-effective from the standpoint of the customers we represent.
And wouldn't you agree that the customers that the office represents would undoubtedly have improved health conditions or other side benefits from that? Is that correct?
I think this goes beyond my testimony, but if the air is cleaner in the Salt Lake Valley, there is ostensibly less health impacts, if that's
okay.
But it goes beyond my testimony in this case.
Great, thank you.
Ms. Roberts.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon,
good
Mr.
afternoon.
Campbell. At the time you filed your direct testimony in this phase, and I'm looking at page 24.
Is your mic on, Ms. Roberts?
24 of your direct testimony. The very top of page 24.
I'm there.
Okay. And you stated, at this point, the commission would need a more complete set of information to accurately determine the value of net metering output and compare it to the total costs of serving a residential net metering customer. Did I read that correctly?
You read it correctly.
But you've changed your view based on Mr. Duval's testimony?
Our position is, has it evolved, as it sometimes does, and depending on the case, often does, as you move from direct to rebuttal to surrebuttal. As you have more evidence presented or you go through the discovery process, sometimes your position on an issue changes, evolves.
Okay. So you're familiar with the commission's order, I guess it's from August 16th, 2013, that the company's witness, Mr. Duval, was asked about on his redirect?
I'm generally familiar with the order. Okay.
And the discussion between the company's attorney and Mr. Duval was that the commission had declined to include other avoided costs as part of the avoided cost payment to qualifying facilities based on the factual record in that case, correct?
You said other avoided costs. What do you mean by that? Can you specify?
I believe it was things such as the fuel hedge value and perhaps some avoided environmental compliance costs were discussed.
I think the commission terminology was environmental risks.
Environmental risks.
Yes.
Okay. Is it your understanding of the commission's order as well that it found the factual record before it at that time inadequate to support including those as part of the avoided cost payment?
It did, and it pointed out, one thing it pointed out is that the RECs stay with the QFs, and that was one reason why they didn't include the hedging, if you will, and the environmental risk, mm-hmm. that they were already compensated sufficiently. That's what the commission opined in its order. It's in my testimony if you want. It's in my surrebuttal if you want to go to that.
I don't not believe you. I'm just thinking. No, okay. I apologize. Under the solar incentive program, some RECs are transferred to the company for installations that they have helped to provide funding to install, correct?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah. I did garble it a bit. Is it your understanding that under the solar incentive program offered by Rocky Mountain Power, it receives some portion of the RECs for rooftop solar installations?
I believe that's the case, but I'd have to check that.
Okay. So that might be a basis that distinguishes rooftop solar installations, at least those that receive solar incentive program funding, from qualifying facilities, correct?
It could be a basis for distinguishing.
Okay. Switching gears a bit, is load growth a driver of increased utility expenses?
It can be.
Okay. And when load increases, what additional costs does the utility incur?
Can we step back to my response to that? It kind of depends on where the commission is in terms, or the commission, the company is in terms of its load resource balance. So if you have loads increasing to make more efficient use of resources, then load growth can actually, if you're in an excess position, you know, beneficial because revenues are allocated over more customers. But if you're in a situation where a utility needs resources, then, you know, load growth can be a driver of cost.
Okay. If peak load is higher, the company has to bring on units from its generation fleet that are more expensive to operate, correct?
That can be the case, but the company heavily relies on market purchases.
Okay.
To fulfill its or satisfy its load needs, and at times you can get those at attractive prices.
So if the company's demand for market purchases goes up due to an increase in load, will they pay more for each unit of energy that they buy on whatever energy exchange they're trading on?
That could possibly be the case. It depends on how they've gone about in terms of securing their market portfolio. I mean, some of this stuff is done significantly ahead of time.
Okay. Let's step back to a more general question, perhaps. Does reducing load growth slow the increase of the utility's revenue requirement as a general matter?
Can you restate that? Sorry.
Does reducing load growth
slow
the increase of the utility's revenue requirement?
It can.
Okay. And is that why energy efficiency programs are deemed a benefit to ratepayers?
They're deemed a benefit because they're evaluated in an IRP process against other alternatives, and if they're cost effective, then they're deemed to be beneficial to ratepayers.
Thank you. So energy efficiency programs do reduce load growth, correct? I don't intend for this to be a trick question. So
the way the company actually treats energy efficiency resources is is like a resource, and they compare it to all other resources in comparing portfolios in their IRPs. And so you'll have energy efficiency as a significant component usually in the portfolios that are tested in their IRP process.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation. Would you agree that reducing load growth is a benefit to other ratepayers?
I think generally, yes. It might depend on the specific situation, but generally, yes.
Okay, thank you. And do qualifying facilities reduce load growth?
No.
Okay. Would you consider that a difference between qualifying facilities and rooftop solar then?
I think they're similar from the standpoint that in terms of the production that comes from a net metering facility is used to meet a net metering customer's load primarily, and then if there's excess, it's put to the grid.
Do qualifying facilities produce energy that they use to meet their own load?
I think some cogeneration projects actually do, and then they sell the excess to the utility.
Okay, but solar qualifying facilities, I guess it's probably more helpful to make that comparison. Does their production result in reduced load growth?
No.
Okay.
Ms. Roberts, if you're going to move to another area, I think we'll take a recess.
I have one or two more questions on this particular topic, and then...
Why don't you finish those?
Okay. Then. Thank you very much, Commissioner. I believe you stated earlier that some significant portion of a rooftop solar net metered customer's own production is used to satisfy its own load, correct?
Correct.
So... you agree that that is a difference between a solar QF and a rooftop solar unit that's net metered?
That appears to be a difference.
Okay. Might that difference be relevant to the benefits that those two systems offer to the utility's system?
From the standpoint of location, there could be a difference in terms of the net metering customer is you know within the distribution system, whereas a solar QF would be you know supplying power you know kind of outside the distribution system. I mean, from a locational standpoint, there would be a difference.
And why is that difference significant, Mr. Gimble? To the benefits assessment?
Because of the proximity of the net metering customer to the feeder, the utility's feeder system versus a solar QF.
The solar QF is more remote from the load?
It could be.
So there's a difference perhaps relating to line losses, and I just want to understand.
It's not something that I looked at.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Let's take a 10-minute recess. We'll start again at 4:35, which might raise the question in some of your minds how late we're going. The chair says 10 o'clock. Does 5:30 work for everyone? Okay. So let's break till 20 till give you a chance to find some cool air somewhere if you can.
Yeah, you need to cool off a little bit.
How can we what?
Gently tell the office that they need to start objecting. Just finish up.
I talked to Brent after he's done with the show. I mean, he came over and asked.
So she totally got up to
I think.